Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, we present a lecture by historian Stephen England. Dr. England is a freelance writer currently living in Paris. He has a Ph.D. in history from Princeton, has taught at UCLA and the University of Paris, and been a staff writer for Time magazine. His most recent book is called Napoleon, A Political Life. Tonight's lecture is one in a series sponsored by the Core Current Affairs Association, an undergraduate group within Boston University's core curriculum. Here now is Stephen England on Napoleon's Lessons for America.
It's great for a writer to come out from behind his desk. I'm not a professor, and so I don't have the habit of speaking, lecturing. And I took up the occasion because anything is easier than writing. And speaking about a book is a lot more fun than having to produce the book. I'm going to give you a talk in several parts. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Napoleon so we can all begin at the same page, kind of. Then I'm going to tell you about the viewpoints, the arguments he sustains, he creates. Then we're going to talk about the 20th century dictators, whether or not really it's useful to see Napoleon as their predecessor, as their model. Then I'm going to talk about his heritage, his legacy, and what we can see in it, derive from it, perhaps. And at last, I'm going to share with you a document I found in the archives, which is really remarkable, and which I found too late to affect my book, but I want to share with you. With Napoleon, I assume we all know what we're talking about, the short general from Corsica, born the year after Corsica became a French holding in 1768. He was born in 69, of impecunious nobility. In fact, the notion that he was a noble is even kind of would make the Corsicans smile. They didn't really have a nobility, but once it was integrated into France, he became part of the French second estate, the nobility. We know that he was educated in France. He went to fine prep school and then the elite military school. And about the time that he was commissioned at the ancient age of 16 in the artillery, Corsica and France entered into the French Revolution. Now, that is what's important at this point. There's an argument about whether Napoleon is Corsican or French, and we can make cases on both sides, and I'm going to tell you it's not really important. It doesn't matter whether he was Corsican or French, because really what his nationality was, what he was a citizen of, was the French Revolution. The revolution of 1789, which was not the first of the democratic revolutions nor the last, was certainly the most important in its aspirations and in its titanic conflicts that it created. I mean, this was a movement that in the fullness of itself wanted to change the calendar and dress and language as well as mere politics, society, and economy. And what it did for Napoleon was to give him a shot at advancement, at integration into a polity, the most important in Europe, France, from a little island that was nowhere, such that he identified with it, which is maybe a different thing from saying he was a doctrinal Jacobin. He was a citizen of the French Revolution because of, as most of the Corsican progressive class was, and French, because of what it offered, of what the possibility it created was. He is commissioned in the French army, advances very quickly because he is a political general identified with the Jacobin party, if you want to call it a party, really. It was the movement in the early 1790s that kept the revolution going, that identified with the French Revolution. And for services rendered to that party, was eventually named to command the French army that campaigned in Italy. The Italian campaign which took up about 15, 16 months in 1796-97, is the moment at which Napoleon delivered the goods and established himself on the stage uniquely, became referred to as not just Frederick the Great, but as Caesar. The Italian campaign, and I wish we had time to go into it, is your classic example of a small army knowing how to maneuver itself and floating like a butterfly and stinging like a bee against larger, heavier, senior-led armies that are not as mobile. And in the course of this 16 months, Napoleon was able to inflict sufficient damage on these Piedmontese Italian and Austrian armies and on generals of considerable experience that he riveted the attention of Europe. And by the end of that campaign, he was no longer one general among others. He was the elite general of his era already at the age of 26, 27. After that, as you recall, he is sent to Egypt. It's a long debate whether they wanted to get rid of him or they genuinely wanted Egypt. I don't know why both couldn't be true. In Egypt, he proceeds on a military scale to duplicate Alexander in, again, the mobility of his army, the crushing defeats he inflicted on superior hosts at certain times, other times inferior hosts, depending on whether he was fighting the Turks, the Brits, or the Mamluks. But adding to the myth, the fact that the British wiped out the French fleet and to some extent Napoleon was trapped in Egypt was far less important back home on the continent than the feat, the military feat that he accomplished in taking Egypt and advancing into Syria. And he probably would have taken more of Syria if Saint-Jean d'Acre hadn't held out. So he returns to France in 1799. I'm going rapidly because I just want to give you the thumbnail here. He returns to France in 1799, not only as a general with an unmatched reputation, but also considerably experienced in statesmanship. He governed in Italy, where he created a republic, and he governed in Egypt not simply as a consul representing the French Revolution and the French government, but to some extent as a state builder. He created states in these two regions that showed Bonaparte, that showed ideas of his own that weren't simply imported from France. So he wasn't simply the French consul, the French Pontius Pilate, as it were. He was his own state builder. He returns to France in 1799. There's an internal crisis in the government, as you perhaps know, and there is something like a bloodless coup. I say it's definitely bloodless, something like a coup, because theoretically speaking, his coming to power in Brumaire of 1799, Brumaire we know is a revolutionary month, named for brume. The revolutionary months were named for weather often, and brume is foggy month. And Napoleon comes to power. He had the advantage of being born aloft by the revolution, but not too identified with its politics, so that he didn't have a past like a lot of the men in government in France. He had that advantage over the others that he hadn't sent people to the guillotine. He hadn't had a partisan past in the 1790s. All right. It's one thing to face the music. It's another thing to dance to it. What's truly amazing now, having established his military reputation, is that in the 4 years of his consulate, when he ran the French Republic as first consul, Napoleon brought off a series of reforms, of consolidations of the French Revolution that have anchored it to the present day, is all I can tell you. The French Republic currently sits on the foundation planks laid by Napoleon during the Great Consulate, the Consulat. Some people would have it the Great Consulate. I'll leave it to you to decide. The franc he stabilized. It's to such an extent that it lasted down to the First World War. The Bank of France he created. The Legion of Honor, which is an award, much coveted to this day. The division of France into administrative units, the judicial reform, you name it. It came out of this incredibly prolific period of the consulate from around 1800 to 1804. He becomes emperor, as we know, the famous coronation where he puts the crown on his own head. By the way, the Pope did expect that. That wasn't a surprise for Pius VII. There in Notre Dame, the empire unfolds over this extraordinary decade in which Napoleon, for the first several years, was emperor of the Republic. He was in some ways the master of the paradox, and emperor of the French Republic was only one of the paradoxes that we could show. Eventually, the coalitions bring him down. After having bested them through the 18, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, after establishing French authority the length and breadth of Europe, far beyond what Charlemagne controlled, various levels of authority. Sometimes he reigned in his own right, other times it was his family who wore the crown, other times it was an allied state subjugated by France. But at one time or another, this short Corsican's writ ran from Lisbon in the west to Moscow in the east, and from, I don't know, Copenhagen in the north to Naples. And of course it didn't last. The coalition, as you know, brought him down the first time in 1814. He did some dazzling footwork of military strategy, but it was of no avail this time. He was sent, as you remember, to this small island off the coast of Italy and France called Elba. And after 10 or 11 months, he escapes. Now is where it gets hallucinogenic. I mean, where it enters into the realm of Joan of Arc kind of history. It's so unexpected. The man, having been exiled, returns to France. The French have every reason to stop him at the beach and say, no more. The French king, Louis XVIII, the restored king, sends one of Napoleon's own marshals against him, who promises to bring him back, as you recall, in an iron cage, and, of course, goes right on over to him along with his men. Napoleon marches north to Paris in this incredible display of nerve and originality, is received by somewhere between 50 and 60% of the population wildly, the others pouting about it, and for 100 days reestablishes the empire in a newly liberalized form, because it was the only way it was going to fly this time around, is brought down at the famous battle on the plains of Waterloo in Belgium, and is exiled to St. Helena, where he stays in one place for the longest time in his life, about 6 years, and then has the good fortune to die fairly young, at 51. And the even greater fortune to die as the enemy of people that everybody hated. Napoleon might well have been hated himself more, except that his enemies, the restored Bourbon kings and their governments and followers, and the restored legitimist emperors and kings of Europe, were hated even more. And so was born the legend of Napoleon, the radical Napoleon, the nationality-loving Napoleon, Napoleon the consolidator of the French Revolution. Like most myths, it contains a good deal of truth and a good deal of myth. All right. There you have it. We're done with part one. We're on the same page. This is the guy we're talking about. The problem with talking about him is nobody can agree. I gave a party in Paris a couple years ago for a leading pair of British scholars of the First Empire, world-class figures. And I thought it would be interesting to have at the table a pair of equally eminent French scholars of the First Empire. Now, folks, these are scholars. These are people trained in reason. They have read acres of scholarship on the First Empire in many languages. And, of course, you can imagine that the dinner broke down into a free-for-all. At one point, the friend whom I gave the dinner with looked at me and said, "What should we do?" And I said, "What we should do, we should be taking notes. This is too good to be true." The journalist in me kind of came out. As a host, it was embarrassing. They really had at each other. And the point, of course, is that all the learning in the world doesn't fundamentally change people's intestinal takes on this Corsican, this hatted Corsican. Keep in mind, his hat was horizontal. Wellington's was vertical. I say this because I'm going to have my own take, which I'm going to share with you, but you must understand that that doesn't mean that it's right or wrong. And what becomes important is how trenchant my view is, how original it is, perhaps. It's very difficult to be speaking about truth when it comes to something like this. The French, by the way, are actually more ambivalent about Napoleon than I've left you thinking. The British aren't. The British scholars attacked him mercilessly and pointed out to the French at the table, I didn't say frogs, I said the French at the table, that every single war of the empire was Napoleon's fault, every single soldier dead was on his conscience, and that's that. The French, they attacked that position naturally. But in fact, the French are characterized by a good deal of ambivalence about the man. The French Republic to this day will not dare to name a street or a square or a boulevard after the Emperor Napoleon, which is a little strange, seeing as how most tourists go to the tomb. The tomb is, it's true, maintained at state expense, but it's in a church, and it's in a military establishment, and it is not a particularly republican institution. The French government finds Napoleon, I don't know, it's in the position that maybe Tom Sawyer would be in talking to Mark Twain. The French Republic owes Napoleon its existence in a lot of ways. As I said to you before, much of the consular reforms is what the Republic is sitting on to this day. And it doesn't know how to say thank you. On the other hand, it disapproves strongly of this man who made himself a monarch. And so it avoids him. Many other French feel a certain tremor because they're attracted. And they don't want to face up to their attraction to a man that they fundamentally don't approve of. Which brings you to your humble servant. For better or for worse, I was a Napoleon buff as a kid. I was already imagining I was going to write a book about him, and I actually started to do this when I was in junior high school, and after 5.5 pages pooped out, I had nothing more to say. But it was a date I made with myself. And if you were to talk to the 12 or 13-year-old Stephen, he would have been full of admiration. The most spurious kinds of sentiments, I hasten to add. And military history. And in the next 45 years, he did a lot of reading of that acres of scholarship I was telling you about. And it dented him. It didn't not have any effect. And what it has given me is a sense of Napoleon as morally ambiguous. What do I mean? How many of you have been to Berchtesgaden in Bavaria? How many of you know what it is? Just raise your hands if you know what Berchtesgaden is. Well, it's a beautiful rural bucolic setting in Bavaria where Adolf Hitler had his residence, his summer residence, and he and Eva spent happy moments. If you visit Berchtesgaden, you'll be struck, I suspect, as I was, by the beauty of it and the absolute hatefulness of it. There is nothing that it evokes that bears mentioning except disgust to me. That's not how I feel about Napoleon. At the Lincoln Memorial, you feel reverent. You feel sad. You feel profoundly moved and admiring. You wish you'd fought for this man's cause. That is not how I feel about Napoleon. And how many have you been to the Invalides, to the Tombeau de l'Empereur in Paris? Okay, well, go. It's interesting. You look down on this swirling porphyry, red kind of granite, crystalline mass, beautifully sculpted, I might add, in the 1850s. It's incredibly modern for a thing from 150 years ago. And it looks back. The abyss looks back. Whom am I quoting there? Right, Nietzsche. You don't feel hope. You don't feel loathing. You feel possibility. And that's not the same thing. And that's what Napoleon evokes in me. And that, were you to take the time to read my book, I guess in our generation you might say he's a Tony Soprano-like character. All right. So it's clear, then, that I don't think it's very helpful to see Napoleon, as he is commonly seen, as the forebear of the 20th century dictators that we reel off. Hitler, Stalin, Mao, Mussolini. I can see why he's compared to them. Peter Hale, a historian whom I revere, wrote in his famous introduction to Napoleon For and Against a comparison of Napoleon and Hitler that is about as well drawn as you can do that sort of thing. And he wrote it in the shadow of the Reich when he was a prisoner himself in Holland. He's Dutch. He was a Dutch historian. And you understand, reading Hale in 1942-43, why he would compare the jackbooted Frenchmen with the jackbooted Germans. But reading it in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, it doesn't quite take. It's not that Napoleon was a nice guy. It has nothing to do with that. It's that the Napoleonic Empire, its project was not to have a totalitarian grip on society. It did not have a police force that was the size of the army. In fact, the French secret police, they're one of the most important bodies of them. The budget was less than the salary of a senator. The French political prisons under the First Empire had a few hundred prisoners. This is not to apologize for it, it's to give you a sense of the dimensions. There were no genocides set up as matters of policy. Government was not by exception and by decision in the Carl Schmitt terms. Napoleon was a kind of dictator, and if we're going to look for precedents, then we should look for a Caesar, perhaps. We should have a sliding scale of authoritarian regimes, perhaps, not just totalitarian and democratic. And if we do that, we will see that Napoleon represents a certain kind of authoritarian regime that is a state of law, that is in some ways a liberal state, even though it is not, by American 20th century standards, a desirable state. I would say, though, that for me, the most compelling reason why I don't think Napoleon is compared profitably to Hitler, or to Stalin, or to Mao, is this. And I'll tell you an anecdote. There was a documentary that I saw a couple of years ago in France. It was about the love in modern-day Russia, the interest that the Russian army has in mounting battles from historical campaigns. Well, we do that in America. I guess people fight the Battle of Gettysburg, don't they? And this is the kind of thing that I would have loved as a kid. And I was watching this. They remounted for this particular documentary the Battle of Borodino in the 1812 campaign. Now, the French invaded Russia in 1812, and it was not a pretty thing. It may perhaps have begun as something like an 18th century war, but it ended in a pretty savage war of national conflict. The Russian peasants really did rise up against the French invaders. And between the Russian peasants and General Winter, as Napoleon called the weather, the French army had the bejesus kicked out of it. They lost hundreds of thousands of men. But here is the Russian army reenacting the Battle of Borodino before Moscow, where the fate of Moscow, the ancient Russian capital, is hanging in the balance. They're reenacting the battle. And what do you think is the source of competition among the Russian officers? This is in 1999, in 2000. What do you think is the competition among them? To play who? Not to play Bagration or Barclay de Tolly or Alexander I. Oh, no, to play Napoleon. I suspect if the Poles reenacted a campaign, they wouldn't be competing to say who got to play Rommel or Hitler. This brought home to me the hold the man has on imagination. There was a colloquium I went to, again, a different illustration of the same sort of thing, a colloquium I went to about the French in Egypt in 1798. We just talked about that. Again, it was not a pretty picture. Napoleon had to kill a lot of people. I mean, he chose it. It was necessary. When you're holding a colony, that's what you do. And there's a rebellion or an insurrection. And eventually he left Egypt under sordid circumstances. And here is this scholarly colloquium in 1998, at which a good deal of Egyptian scholars are there, with French scholars and American scholars and British scholars, and they're all arguing about that son of a bitch did no good for the Egyptian scholars, for Egypt, and it would have been better if he hadn't come. But finally somebody stood up and said, it's interesting, though, we're together and we're discussing it, and we're discussing the pluses and the minuses. That already makes it ambiguous. The same in Spain. The Spanish have every reason to hate the man. The Spanish campaign was savage, worse than the Russian or the Egyptian. And yet, today you will find Spanish scholars debating the question of what the French brought, the pluses and the minuses. This is what makes the man different from 20th century dictators. Now, I've run out of ammunition. In fact, Napoleon, if he were here, would want me to compare him to Washington. I'm not going to do that. He might actually want me to compare him to Teddy Roosevelt if we're going to start picking American subjects. Maybe Charles de Gaulle, but I don't think he'd be too attracted by de Gaulle, because de Gaulle was a leader of a defeated, beaten nation. And Napoleon, well, we'll get to that, what he would identify with. But Teddy Roosevelt, perhaps. George Washington, he did talk about a lot, though. He respected Washington, genuinely respected him. But he said on St. Helena, and this is worth coming back again, he said at St. Helena about Washington, if he were in my shoes, yeah, if I were in his shoes, yeah, maybe I would have left power twice. Left military power and then political power and retired like Cincinnatus behind my plow. But if he were in my shoes and he acted like George Washington, the French Revolution and the forces it unleashed would have gobbled him up in a second. Those means wouldn't have worked in the vortex of the maelstrom of our revolution. And although I respect Washington, it's not the same thing. Maybe he was wrong. Maybe not. It's also interesting to note, in the 19th century, long after he was dead, who was invoking him? And in the 20th century, for that matter, do you think Hitler was invoking Napoleon? In 19th century England, the English have every reason to hate him, and we've established that they do. But those British groups that would invoke Napoleon were the Chartists and the Radicals, fighting against the British conservative government, invoking the Napoleon of St. Helena, the Napoleon of the French Revolution, the Napoleon of the opponent of the kings, is to show you the heritage. Today, Charles Napoleon, a descendant of the emperor, is running for mayor, or was running for mayor in Ajaccio in Corsica. And he's running as a socialist, invoking Napoleon. He's standing, I might add, against the Bonapartist party. There is a formal Bonapartist party, and you can imagine how they feel about a man named Charles Napoleon Bonaparte invoking the emperor on behalf of a left-wing. But it's possible. That's part of the heritage. It's what I'm trying to establish to you makes him different. Okay, the legacy. Well, we can give you the ham and eggs legacy that you've heard a million times, and I suppose we can't not say. The grand homme tradition, the 18th century tradition of great hero. Hegel, this is for you, Lydia. Hegel talks about him. Hegel, there's an example of a great German philosopher who should have perhaps known better, some of you might say, and yet was seduced. Understood the downsides of Napoleon, but was overall seduced by the figure of the spirit, the Geist on horseback. Writes about in Reason in History, writes a wonderful 7 or 8 pages about the great man tradition, in which he talks about Caesar and Alexander, and never once mentions Napoleon, except that anyone reading it knows precisely that it was Napoleon that gave rise to these pages. One legacy. The legacy of the consulate we've already talked about, the political legacy that France is standing on today, and so is Louisiana, I'm told, the Code Napoleon, for example. The legacy of democratic legitimacy is little subtler. The notion that a dictator in our era, in the 19th and 20th century, can no longer be dictator by divine right or by the church, but has to somehow or other establish his claim to power on the nation, on the people. And this gives rise to a rich variety of regimes. It's hard for us to keep that well in mind in America because we're so familiar with the same stable constitution and regime that we've enjoyed for 200 years plus now. Other democratic regimes, whether in France or other countries, have had a whole gamut of experience in styles and forms of dictatorship, of democracy, of authoritarian democracy, of authoritarian republics. And much of this draws from the experience, the legacy of the Corsican. What interests me, and if it interests you, I suggest you read some of my 562 pages. What interests me is one aspect of Napoleon's political heritage. I want to say a paradox. Napoleon, for me, represents the politics of anti-politics. Now, what do I mean by that? One of his opponents, oh, and this is so characteristic, his name is Benjamin Constant. And Benjamin Constant, when you read some of his sentences written as a diatribe against the empire, by God, you'd think you understand whom this man doesn't like. And you would therefore be very surprised to find that the week after some of this stuff was published, he accepted a post in Napoleon's government. We won't talk about the morality of some intellectuals. Constant has a phrase: the danger of modern politics is that the comforts of modern living will lead citizens to neglect politics altogether, leaving them vulnerable to exploitation by politicians. The French language has a distinction which we don't have in English. La politique means politics. But there's also le politique, which means the political, in a larger sense. Politics, we know. Parties, parliaments, press, doctrines, platforms, the usual, the P's, I call them. But le politique, the political, is more ambiguous, is more nuanced. Napoleon understood in society that all is political. He understood that religion is political, that culture can be political, that social conflict can end up political. He understood that politics is the last stage where it starts to get, where the rubber hits the road, where conflict happens and has to be regulated. And he understood that political conflict, in whatever form it happens, cultural, economic, ethnic, racial, has to be controlled. And he would like to see it controlled by the state. Being a man of state, his ideal would be that the political, le politique, das politische, is controlled by this institution, this government, this state, this bureaucracy. That's a very Napoleonic desideratum and understanding. But what Napoleon didn't like was politics in terms of parties, partisanship, doctrines, press. And that's hard for us to understand. We might understand it a tad better if we had gone through the upheavals of 1792, 93, 94, and we had seen the terror hustle off the tens of thousands to their death for political reasons. We might have understood the desperation with which the French sought a way out of the revolution without destroying the revolution, a way of consolidating it without bringing the king and the old regime back. And they tried many ways. They didn't lightly settle for the consulate in the empire. But when they did, they got a man who had had enough of politics while yet understanding the power of the political. And understanding French contempt for politics. A contempt we still live with. We Americans are actually closer to the French than we used to be in this regard. We have developed a healthy or an unhealthy contempt ourselves for politics. But the French have always had it. They don't even, in their language, although they have the nuance between le and la politique, they do not have the nuance that we have between policy, good, and politics, supposedly bad. In French, it's just la politique. And the moment you say it, or use the verb faire de la politique, do politics, or politiciser, if you want to create a word in slang, the moment you say that, it's pejorative. It has a pejorative connotation. Napoleon isn't responsible for that, but the culture of the late 18th century and the revolution was the same as it is today. In that regard, there hasn't been much history, much change. Napoleon's legacy was to create a regime wherein the political no longer got referred to political, to parties and partisanship and platforms and debate, but got referred to parades and glory and victories and annexations and administrative reform and public works, sewers, lighting, architectural triumphs, Arc de Triomphe, I was about to say. Didn't get actually built until after Napoleon was out of power, but it was his idea, the large arch to his victories. His legacy was to create a political form that did what Constant feared. It governed by show. It governed by administration. It did not govern, as in the Anglo-Saxon, the Anglo-American tradition, by the clash of interests and parties and political conflict control. It governed by other forms of solidarity, for good and for ill. It was a different way, and a way that is very foreign to us as Anglo-Americans. Napoleon himself, by the way, refused ever to found a party. That's another thing that makes him different from the 20th century dictators. He didn't found a Bonapartist party, contrary to what you might have thought from the example I gave you about Charles Napoleon in Corsica. The Bonapartist party that he's opposing is a late 19th century product, not a Napoleonic product. Napoleon wanted nothing to do with parties. And if you read my book, if you read anyone's book about the First Empire, you see how it is le political, le politique, the political, does its work in a form of anti-politics. I leave you with that paradox. And now I'm going to share with you my discovery. It's very rare that a historian working on Napoleon ever finds anything new. There's nothing new to find. It has all been searched out before. And the challenge in writing about Napoleon does not come in research. It comes in words. It comes in metaphors and tropes and similes and or not. But as luck would have it, I found a document that I'm going to share with you. It is a memorandum from Napoleon I, Emperor of the French, to George W. Bush, President of the United States of America. Monsieur le Président, from the tops of those stels in Baghdad, three millennia of history look down on the American presence in Iraq. Admiringly for a time, now very dubiously, harshly, this too can change. Doesn't matter how it is viewed. What matters is your decisiveness, monsieur, your decision. We are brothers in arms, you and I. You came to Iraq in 2003. I came to Egypt in 1798. Like me, you won the day militarily. Indeed, you won it more quickly than I did, for it took me many months and tens of thousands of lives to overthrow the evil Mamluk government. I envy you in having the good fortune of having the British on your side. I had them against me, and so I eventually lost what would have been the finest jewel in my crown. I went on to great things, as you have known, as you know, but none of them was greater than my short-lived triumph in the land of the pharaohs. I understood that this enterprise was for the long haul, that the Near East was a great prize and would be one of France's greatest colonies in the coming century. We French accepted that we must make our mark here, and we invested thriftily, if effectively, in setting up an efficient administration, and we undertook extensive infrastructural and scientific projects. If I write you now, it is to help you see your course clearly and to stay it at this particularly crucial juncture. You have innumerable advisors and subordinates, but they cannot reveal to you, as I can, the future that awaits you. The world is at a turning point, and you have a large decision to make. If I speak bluntly, Monsieur le Président, it is because I sense in you something of a kindred spirit. You are, like me, not a man to question or doubt, not a politician to ask useless questions or to ponder the polls and the polls. But you have been too remote, too, shall I say, implicit. The time has come to step forward. I speak to you now not as a Frenchman to an American, but as a ruler to another. In the current state of world affairs, it is unquestionably your country that rivets my attention, not the ungrateful nation that I adopted and conducted to its summit of glory. France's current international policy is moralistic posturing, a nostalgie de ma grandeur. She is obsessed with American power and influence, yet she hasn't the means or the will, only the burning desire to imitate America. Her impotence is no less arrogant, but far less interesting than American power and American arrogance. I came to Egypt with a better knowledge of the religion of Muhammad than you had initially. However, I did not have the priceless advantage that you have, Monsieur Bush, of being a religious man, of being a man unencumbered by any trace of irony. On the contrary, my offer to convert myself and my whole army to Islam was greeted with hoots of disbelief and derision by the locals, who only continued to see in me and the French Jacobin destroyers of religion that we had been in France. So pay your respects to Allah, Mr. Bush. But now I come to my point. Do not let that charade lead you to dealing feebly with the efforts of the factional forces, the Shiites, the Sunnis, the Kurds. They jockey for place, portraying you as infidels. We French were so portrayed. But we patiently continued to work with local Mohammedan, as what we call them, authorities, to build an infrastructure, while behind the scenes I brilliantly played off their parties, one against the other. Do the same, mon ami. A few billion dollars in bakshish and the religious conflict will take care of itself. Your great enemy, hunted down like a mad dog, is in your hands at last. I congratulate you. Throughout the Middle East, as well as in North Korea, Libya, Pakistan, your strength is so feared that it does not matter that your name is reviled. Strong leaders are always opposed, always criticized, always reviled. I envy you. Yes, I envy you. For you hold an international supremacy that I never achieved, even at the height of my empire. The British were always there to oppose me, as the Soviets are no longer there to oppose you. The great difference between my incursion into Egypt and yours in Iraq, however, lies in self-understanding. We French simply accepted that we were there to stay. We accepted the mantle of hegemony. No less than you did we know ourselves to be, quote, a nation with a mission, and that mission comes from our most basic beliefs, a forward strategy of freedom. I'm quoting you, Monsieur le Président. Profit from this historic situation to know your own mind, even if you do not share it with reporters at your press conference tonight. Act globally. Do not allow mere domestic considerations to deflect you, as I did when I left Egypt too precipitously in 1799. Stay fixed on your goal of imposing the New World Order that your father spoke of. That order may not be as democratic as you intend, but it will constitute a decisive improvement for American national interest over what has existed heretofore. Steal your ideologues' ideas and then throw away their authors. The neoconservative intellectual, like his liberal counterpart, is a vain, self-serving prig, and in the end, a political naive. People who do not wear the mantle of state as we do cannot know the weight of responsibility nor hear the call of glory. You are not the military leader I was, and that greatest of glories is therefore denied you. Military victory in your era isn't what it was in mine, though it is more than the pacifists say that it is. But geopolitical glory can be yours if you know how to mix realism with sang-froid and with patience. Embrace your destiny, Monsieur le Président. Accept the empire that is yours and bring your people to do so. They will grumble at first, but in the end, they will appreciate the leader who made them slough off their silly anti-colonial prejudice. In their hearts, Americans have always implicitly understood what the French of my era did when I reigned as emperor of the French Republic. And that is this: a republic may well contain within herself the seeds of empire. Rome taught us as much. Open the throttle of the popular imagination. Only be clear that what is at stake here is not the conversion of the world to Christ, but the clear, steady, abiding imposition of American democracy on a world that does not yet know, but will, that it needs it. This is not going to be easy. The civilized world of my day embraced the French revolutionary cause with far more of a continental union than you are managing to raise in your so-called coalition. Accept that changes will occur at home. that America will become more authoritarian, less liberal. She will still be, as was the France of my empire, a society of law. But she will have to become more, not less, indifferent to politics and parties, to the nattering nabobs of negativism, and become more focused on the focused action of lobbies. Depoliticize this issue of American global power. Do as I did. Make it a matter of national interest so that its opponents are seen as unpatriotic. Do not mollycoddle your people, as you did in parts of your State of the Union address. Tell the American people forthrightly, forget your domestic programs, think empire. Make war well when you have to, and you will be seen as a peacemaker. Lose, and you'll be seen as a warmonger. Morality and religion are out of place in weighing these factors. What is needed to run states is not humility, but superbia, audacity. Embrace your destiny, monsieur. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Thank you.
You've been listening to historian Stephen England on Napoleon's Lessons for America. Tonight's lecture was part of a series sponsored by the Core Current Affairs Association, an undergraduate group within Boston University's core curriculum. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Michael Garth and Matt Odette with help from Boris Trapochki. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.